Hello and welcome to Agents of Hope. Now, I'm quite clearly not Tim Cox. My name is Ella Mansfield and I'm taking over the podcast for like a little mini series which I'm calling Understanding Voices. And I'm going to be talking to people who have had experiences or interest in groups that we might not hear about all that much. And it's sort of in an attempt to understand people with less typical backgrounds and experiences and reduce kind of unconscious discrimination in practice. So if you want to know a little bit more about the mini-series, me and Tim recorded a little introduction to it, and that also tells you a little bit about what Tim's doing at the moment. So go and check that out on whatever podcast platform you're using. Today, I am really, really excited to welcome Cora Sargent as my guest. We're going to be talking about gender and how gender is not as simple as the kind of bimodal system of male and female. Speaking to Cora was absolutely fascinating, and she told me about her own gender journey and about how we can facilitate inclusive practice and how we support young people with their own gender identities too. So without much further ado, I'm so excited to share this with all of you.
Cora, I wonder if we could start by, could you tell us a little bit about who you are and how you came to become an educational psychologist?
Sure thing. Hello. Thanks for inviting me onto the podcast. It's an enormous privilege. Thank you very much. All my colleagues are sort of raving about Agents of Hope and now super impressed that I've been invited to come on. So thanks very much. That's super kind of you. Yeah, so I'm Cora Sargent. I'm an educational psychologist by trade and a senior teaching fellow at the University of Southampton, where Sarah Wright and I sort of head up the EP Gender Research Group. Sarah's the director of the Educational Psychology Doctorate, where I spend most of my time. And there we have a group of amazing trainee and now very qualified educational psychologists who have come together to conduct research in this field, in the field of gender diversity, really, with the aim of, broadly speaking, kind of answering two big questions. One is kind of, what genders is it possible for a person to be in the world? And the other is, what makes a person the gender that they are? And that's led us in all kinds of directions. It's been great fun, honestly. And it's all made possible by some absolutely outstanding trainee EPs who have research interests in this field and have joined us in the group. So yeah, huge appreciation to them.
Yeah, thank you. That was a great introduction. So I think a good place to start might be, I'd love to know more about your journey into becoming an EP. And I wonder if you could tell us about the areas you're interested in and how that's kind of, you know, sculpted you as an educational psychologist.
Yeah, I mean, my journey into educational psychology was a bit of an unusual one, I guess, because I wanted to be a clinical psychologist for a long time. Yeah, I know.
Many of us do.
That's, you know, clinical psychology. It has this kind of glamour, I think, associated with clinical psychology that ed psychs have, as a profession, we've just not quite been able to achieve. Even though I think I love educational psychology, I do it not because it's just what I was able to do, but because it's, you know, it's something that I love. Mm-hmm. And I was working for like brain injury charities and in mental health provisions, and for I spent a couple of years working as an assistant psychologist in a therapeutic community for sort of young people and adults with quite complex emotional needs. It was absolutely outstanding work, and some of the work that has kind of really shaped who I am as an educational psychologist, I suppose. And from there, I ended up working in Hampshire as an assistant psychologist in educational psychology proper. And it was only at that point that I think I really started to understand what educational psychology was, and that it is a discipline around solving problems. Mm. And solving problems that are sort of the most moral problems to solve. You have a group of young people in an education system that is a bit one size fits all, and with amazing staff in schools who are desperately trying to do their best, but in a curriculum that's kind of maybe a little bit not as broad and balanced as we'd hope, and maybe not as easy to tailor to individual needs. Mm. And understanding why some children get left behind and how we can bend this system to accommodate their needs and make sure that they are fully included is just the most fun kind of problem to solve. Mm-hmm. I've always really enjoyed it. So from there, I met amazing educational psychologists and used to go to the CPD events held by Hampshire, which I think are legendary. And that compelled me to apply, and I got on at Southampton. And the rest is kind of history, really. I've never looked back. But I guess my kind of, you know, I'm a transgender woman, everyone. And that has been a big part of my journey. That when I went to Southampton, I applied as, you know, a boy, at least to everybody else's perception and understanding, as Tom. Mm-hmm. And I sort of transitioned after my first year, sort of in the transition from year one to year two. I started the process of transition. And that has become kind of a center, like a big part of who I am as an EP, by necessity in a weird way, because you can't really get away from it. As I have found, like, being transgender is something that is a rare thing, I think, in professional psychology, in the professions broadly, perhaps. I don't think I've met any other transgender EPs out there. I'd love to hear from them. If anybody's out there, a transgender EP, and you're like, oh my goodness, I want to get in touch with Cora, come and get in touch with me, because I am desperate to hear from people. It can get a little lonely out there, even though the profession has been the most welcoming and has been a wonderful place. I was at the DECP conference a couple of years ago, and I mentioned that I felt very privileged that educational psychology is a profession that has kind of given me a home. And I really appreciate that about this profession, that from the first time that I sort of started to come out to Sarah, who has been my mentor for many, many years, and her just profound acceptance of me as a person and support in my coming out and transition, and all through the multiple local authorities that I was placed in, all the way to working for a long time in Wiltshire, I found the profession to be wholly inclusive of gender diverse individuals. So cheers for that, everyone. I think it looked a bit touch and go when I came out, because we had lots of, I had colleagues who were worried about what the profession would be like. You know, it was untested, I think, in this way. And you're working with people's children, and there's few more sensitive jobs, and people can get very worried about, who's working with their children. And there were touch and go moments in local authorities, like local authorities wondering whether we needed to warn schools that a transgender member of staff was going to be working with them before I turned up. And legal departments and local authorities saying that like my supervisors, when they wrote references for me, were not allowed to write any pronouns in reference, okay. Pronouns at all. If you've ever tried to write anything about a person without using pronouns, recognize how challenging that is. So it was touch and go for a while. We really didn't know if it was possible for a transgender person to do this job. And thankfully we've just found that it is. Which I think is wonderful. I mean, I acknowledge the privileged position, though, that being a white woman, apart from anything else, but more being able to kind of pass in the world. Historically, when I think I'm in a privileged position where I've had the privilege of anonymity being able to be my first line of defense in the job. I don't tell many parents that I'm transgender on the whole, because it's not relevant. I mean, if people ask, I'll tell them. And children ask all the time. I have kids that come up to me in the middle of the street and will be like, are you a boy or a girl? And I'm like, yeah, I'm a girl. Get out of here, kid. But that happens all the time. I had this amazing situation in a supermarket once while I was mid-transition. This little one tugged at her mother's sleeve in Sainsbury's, like I was picking up oranges off the shelf or something, and this little one pointed at me and she was like, "Mum, why is that man wearing a dress?" I was like, oh, there's trouble. And mum was like, "I don't know, why don't you go and ask him?" In this really inclusive way, as inclusive as you can manage, this little one looked at me and I gave her a look and was like, "Don't you dare." I didn't really. Super welcoming. Come on over and ask questions, little one. She didn't, of course. She was tiny and embarrassed. But moments like that happen all the time. But beyond that, and beyond the kind of advocacy work we do a little bit of, and I do a bunch of trainings around the place because it's fun to talk about this stuff, and finding the humor in the weird experiences that I have has been a good way of managing it, so why not turn it into something? But most of the time I don't tell people, and I'm privileged enough that people don't know to look at me all that often, which is, yeah, it's obviously a privileged position.
Mm. So obviously your transition must have had a really big influence on you as you went through your training. And I kind of wonder, how was that for you? Because it must have been quite a lot of emotional strain at the time. And then obviously doing the course as well. I mean, the course is kind of, it's stressful enough, isn't it?
I mean, now that I am a tutor on the course and I know, you know, how pressured and how challenging the course is for people, yeah. I think, gosh, transition, hypothetically, transition must be really challenging to do that at the same time. But then I've met people who have had children on the course and who have multiple competing demands, or who are carers in the community, you know, and are just, you know, people are rock and roll. They really are. I love them. But, you know, in my first year at the university was the most difficult year because I hadn't kind of come out, but I was on that sort of precipice edge where I had increasingly understood what the problem was that I'd been experiencing over many years. Because I knew when I was a little person and would steal my mum's clothes when I was young and wear them around the house and just wild stuff like that. And so I knew that something was up when I was young, but being a little person, we didn't really have any role models around at the time, and certainly didn't have the language to describe my experience until I became an adult and started to learn what I thought was going on. So by the time I got into the course at about 28 or something, I had clocked what the problem was, and I had the language to describe it. But I knew that to sort of come out would be to risk losing everything. You know, I didn't know that it was possible to have a career if I came out. I didn't know that, you know, what would happen to my marriage, you know, because Kaz and I were just about getting married at that point. I don't think we were quite married, but we were on the way. I think we were married. What, 2007. That was the same time.
Okay, yeah.
And so we were like, you know, it was a tough old moment. But that first year, I was surrounded by beautiful women being like strong women in the world and just being effortlessly themselves.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, the only guy on the course, and I was just sort of awkward. And I was increasingly kind of faced with the sort of idealized version of me that I couldn't be.
Mm.
And that was the tough bit, really. And so during that year, I was like, I think I have to come out. Like, I don't think, you know, I think if I was to write a memoir, it'd be called something like Between a Frock and a Hard Place, because
yeah, I love that.
That's terribly 1960s of me. But, you know, because you kind of, in that moment, you're sort of deteriorating emotionally because you understand the problem, you know what you have to do, but to do it is to, you know, potentially do something terrible to your life, self-destructive in a way. So you sort of, it's not really a choice at that point. Like, it never really was a choice to be trans, but, you know, to transition sort of, like, I was putting it off for years and years, and in the end, selling to myself the idea that it was too late as my main defense. Like, it's too late. If I was 23, if I was 17, I could have done it. If I was 23, I could have done it. And if I'm, you know, when I was 28, it was like, it's too late. And I had people like George McLean and Becky Murphy, peers on the course, who were like, you know, I remember George and I having conversations. She was just like, too late, is it though? and their support sort of, you know, that was it, really. I thought, yeah, we've got to do it. And once I'd done it, like, the weight that had been on my shoulders, I only really knew had been there by it being lifted by that act. And so it was actually, in a sense, sort of way, it was not necessarily easier, but certainly better following the kind of start of transition than it had been beforehand, for sure. But you know, supervisors and, you know, countless placement supervisors, thesis supervisors, and the core staff generally just being that supportive was probably what made it that possible and that positive an experience, really.
Yeah. So it sounds like you had really good support around you at the time, and sort of I suppose when you're on the course, you do change a lot. Like, I found that my perceptions of myself, my identity, has changed a lot very short space of time. And I can see how, that inevitability of that was something that you always kind of felt, and it just kind of turned into this kind of this leap during the time that you're on the course. And the release
the release, the terrible inevitability of it, in a sense, because you're looking at the risk of just sabotaging the life that you had created for yourself, I was worried that I wouldn't be married afterwards or have a job or be on a course and I'd be in trouble. Thankfully, the world was just inclusive enough, I think, that we managed to kind of ride a wave of people coming out and of trans awareness. When I was, there was just this, we were cresting a wave, which, so standing on the shoulders of giants is what we were doing, which is, appreciate those who have come before always, and the path that they paved for us.
Yeah. Obviously, the world has changed quite a bit in terms of how we think about and conceptualise being transgender, and the way we conceptualise gender as a whole as well. Since then, I think things have changed. It's certainly become more of an area of interest, hasn't
it?
So I wonder if maybe you could tell us a little bit about gender and how research has shaped our perception of gender.
Yeah, for sure. I suppose there are two big concepts that it's worth bearing in mind. One is the sort of role of socialization, and the other is the role of essentialism, with socialization being the idea that how you experience your gender can be malleated to some degree by your experience, shaped by your experience. And essentialism is the idea that what makes you a gender is essential to you. It's like essentially different to other genders, something core and unchanging, immalleable in a way. And the research has bounced between these two concepts over time, I think. And in increasingly sophisticated ways, we've come to a sort of more sophisticated understanding of how gender can be expected to work. So I think pre kind of 1960s, we had a sort of very Darwinian essentialist view of gender, that really there are only two genders, male and female, and which gender you are can be determined at birth by looking down, basically, and that they're in a set of associated sort of psychological, physiological, social, behavioural characteristics that set one gender apart from the other, right? Super essentialist view. And cognitive psychology, sort of behaviourism paved the way to cognitive psychology, where the over-application of behaviorism started to find its way to gender theory, where we started to wonder, Kohlberg was a part of this, more cognitive psychology than behaviorism, really. But behaviorism started to generate two big ideas. One, that your gender could be shaped, your interests, your behaviors, bearing in mind that gender identity as a term doesn't really exist in the way that we would describe it now. Kohlberg's definition of gender identity is the ability to sort of correctly identify one's own gender as male or female. But today we talk about gender identity being that core nugget of who you are as a person, like what feels like home in terms of gender, what you are inside. So behaviorism kind of taught us two things. One, that your gendered interests could be shaped by rewards and punishment. And the other, that it was adaptive to be behaving in accordance with your assigned gender, right? So the idea began to blossom that children would have a gender, a sex, they'd be assigned that sex, and then they grow up learning about how to do gender well. That's a very sort of cognitive gender schema theory kind of idea, that we are motivated to do gender well. And so we learn about what gender is, male and female, we learn about which we are, and then we're motivated to do that well. So we look to role models around us, we look to the gender behaviors and interests of other people, we populate those schema, and then we sort of apply them to ourselves and leap on in and start to try and be a good man or be a good woman as best we can. And that it was adaptive to do that, and to do anything else was maladaptive. And of course, those ideas are super problematic, because you know, when we're talking about gender diversity and people that might not experience themselves to adhere to the binary at all, and to, you know, people who are gender fluid, whose gender identities might flex over time, and of course for the transgender community who might identify with a gender that's different to the one that they've been assigned, those ideas are really problematic because their very existence in the world is considered maladaptive in some way, problematic. And also, their existence in the world can be blamed on situational factors, right? So we can draw conclusions like, if you've been raised in a feminine way, you might become a woman, right? You might think of yourself as a woman in a maladaptive way, and that might be problematic in some way. That might be, you might generate that as a mental health problem for yourself or for your child if you encourage that in them. Bearing in mind, none of this holds true in modern research, but this was the sort of, this is our history, and the history that shaped public policy. So in 1988, I want to say, we had, of course, Margaret Thatcher's famous speech about sexual diversity in modern language, mm-hmm. but she said, and trigger warning for everyone at home, this stuff is verbatim. Mm-hmm. She said, children who need to be taught to respect traditional moral values are being taught that they have an inalienable right to be gay. All of those children are being cheated of a sound start in life, which is amazing, mm-hmm. and was spoken to sort of uproarious applause. And
it wasn't that long ago either. That's what really gets me about that.
I think that's what blows my mind. Because, yeah. you know, we were alive while, I mean, I was certainly alive. So Section 28, 1988, but didn't get repealed until 2003. And for those who don't know, Section 28 basically prohibited schools from promoting, in inverted commas, the teaching of the acceptability of homosexuality as a pretended family relationship. Even the terminology is wild to look back on now. Mm-hmm. So that kind of, it sort of makes sense in terms of some of the psychology that was being generated at the time, right? That we thought that was maladaptive, potentially maladaptive, to find yourself in a sort of rarer places on the gender spectrum. And that if you did, it could well be the consequence of how those sort of schema were populated, or the role models you had access to, or how you were raised, the rewards and sanctions of your environment. Really dangerous ideas, really. Yeah, and again, that law remained until sort of 2003. And of course, it meant that schools couldn't support sexual diversity, couldn't support gender diversity at all. And I think really put the brakes on our sort of public development, our development of sort of inclusive practice in schools for like 15 years. Wild stuff. Mm-hmm. But in the midst of all that, I do want to talk about Sandra Behm's work, because Behm's work, it's still a kind of product of the time. So some of Behm's writings are still a little bit kind of schema theory-ish. I think Behm is kind of at the heart of some of gender schema theory. But Behm, in the midst of all this, came up with this idea that gender could be conceived along two spectra, masculinity and femininity, and that a person could be kind of high on masculinity and low on femininity, or high on femininity and low on masculinity, regardless of their assignment. Like, it was rare for a person to be sort of cross gender identified, mm-hmm. in that way. But still, in her work, she was finding sort of 6% of the population were somewhat identified in that way. Or it was possible for people to be both highly masculine and highly feminine, or sort of low masculinity and low femininity in a sort of slightly more non-binary space. And her thought was that these were inherently adaptive positions. These are okay ways of being in the world. Now, the research that sort of followed Behm started to suggest that these rarer positions on Behm's measurements were associated with negative emotional, medical, mental health outcomes for the populations that populated them. And that sort of confirmed for some researchers the idea that it was inherently maladaptive to populate those spaces. But more recent research did some amazing stuff. People like Martin, Gulgoz, Olson, Ray, some amazing modern researchers, went back to some of those positions and recognized that those rarer positions, sure, were related to negative outcomes, potentially, for the individuals that populated them, but they also were related to higher social anxiety and lower sense of belonging, particularly for some of those positions, low sense of belonging and high social anxiety for like the cross-gender identified. But even for people who found themselves low masculinity and low femininity, that position's still associated with quite a lot of low sense of belonging. And so what we think is happening here is that these positions aren't inherently problematic. In fact, some of the more modern research finds that they're certainly not inherently problematic or maladaptive, but that they are associated with low belonging and high social anxiety because the world hasn't been set up with a view to accepting them. It hasn't been set up with gender diversity in mind. I mean, people have to make, as Bragg highlights in 2010, I want to say, that children, even in the modern world, even in today's world, have to make frequently binary choices about what gender they are just when they go to the bathroom. You know, you have to say, am I a boy or a girl? And head into one of those stalls. If you're a non-binary young person, what do you do? Rarely do we have kind of unisex toilets. Rarely do we have spaces that have been designed with the idea that gender might be more diverse than masculine and feminine. And that is incredible to me. I think some of this more modern research, like Olson's work and Gulgo's and Ray, really interesting work around kind of comparing transgender young people to their cisgender siblings and cisgender peers, and identifying that like trans girls are just very similar to cisgender girls, mm-hmm. and trans boys are just very similar to cisgender boys in all of these kind of both explicit and implicit measures. For those listening at home, implicit measures are about sort of how you in an unconscious way associate two concepts in your mind. Mm-hmm. So we find that for trans girls, they kind of associate themselves with feminine qualities in an implicit way, mm. as well as an explicit way. So it's not that these children are like pretending. It's not that these children are making it up, or they think that that's what the researcher wants to hear. It's, we think pretty sophisticatedly now, this research has come to the conclusion that, you know, these trans girls and boys are just like any other girl or boy. Mm-hmm. And importantly, when they are, one of these really interesting pieces of research compares children who transitioned a little bit later, who were supported a little bit later, and children who were supported a little bit earlier. And of course, the social model, socialization model, would expect people who had been supported a little later, let's say we've got two trans girls, one who's supported from the age of 5 or 6 and has been presenting as a girl for like 6 years at age 11. Mm-hmm. And then we have another 11-year-old trans girl who was only supported at age 10. You know, parents took a while to feel okay to support them, and they'd been presenting as a boy for all that time. Mm-hmm. We would expect in a socialization model that that second trans girl might be more masculine or at least less feminine than the other trans girl, be less interested in feminine things, have weaker implicit association, but we just don't find that. What we're finding is that this nugget of gender identity, it can't really be malleated by our actions. And essentialism is a good way to think, but not in terms of like deterministically, not that your assignment as male or female will absolutely determine your gender, but rather this nugget of gender identity, you're sort of born with it. It might change over time on its own. It might be flexible in some people, but whatever it is, working out what it is a journey of authentic gender discovery, and we're not going to change it manually by our kind of inviting of people to think about it. I think we need to move away from the idea. I think schools exist in a legacy of Section 28, worried that their actions could, you know, could be problematic in some way. They could malleate a child's sexuality or gender identity by inviting them to think about it. I think we need to move away from that idea. I think we're getting to the point now where we get a good sense that young people's gender identity will be what it will be, much like their sexuality. We can't raise them straight. We can't raise them gay. It's just a question of giving them the language to wonder about it for themselves, mm-hmm. and, you know, accepting them wherever they may land.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like the research is kind of saying that there is certainly a lot of socialization that takes place to mold gender. But also there's like this little, as you called it, like a little nugget of almost an innate kind of biological self discovery of gender.
Yeah, I think if we break it down into like the genderbred person's a really good model of gender. Yeah. It hasn't been scientifically sort of empirically validated, but we're working mm-hmm. on it. The genderbred person is a really good one, which separates out gender into three bits: biological configuration, gender identity and gender expression. So biological configuration is kind of how your body is configured in relation to gendered anatomy, like primary and secondary sexual characteristics. Your chromosomes would fall into that. Gender identity is a tricky one to define, but it's like the only thing within any given gender identity, such as man or woman, you know, amongst others, is a deep-seated sense of identification with that concept. The term rings true, it holds meaning. Something inside of us says, yes, that feels like home, that's what I am. Mm-hmm. And then gender expression is the performance of your gender to the world and to yourself. And of course, your gender expression, you have a lot of control over. It's kind of, you know, what we consider feminine or masculine is very culturally framed. We learn how to do that well. Well's a bit of a weird word, but we know what kind of constitutes more feminine or masculine styles of dress and mannerisms and ways of talking. And so we have conscious control over it, even though our performance of our gender is often designed to kind of give an indication to the world of how we identify. It isn't the same thing. So people like Courtney Act, who, if anybody watches RuPaul's Drag Race, welcome to the family. RuPaul's Drag Race is amazing. Courtney Act is a legendary Australian drag queen, and she talks about how Courtney is a part of who she is, but her gender identity is still definitely male. Like, she feels at home as Shane, mm-hmm. but Courtney Act, as this part of gender expression, is still very much a part of who she is as a person, but identity and expression being slightly different things. And for me, you know, my gender expression, I shape quite heavily in order to kind of give the world a clear sense that I identify as a girl, and I'd quite like you to relate to me as one. I think what we're finding, I think Hyde did a really beautiful piece recently, which is about challenging the gender binary on each of these three ideas. Even in terms of biological configuration, the gender binary probably doesn't hold true for a lot of people. The sort of diversity of bodies is just too great to consider a binary view to be a reasonable way of thinking about everyone. Mm-hmm. And the same for identity, the same for expression. So the model that we arrive at, if we sort of pull Bem's idea and the genderbread person together, is that there's kind of feminine and masculine, like, what's the word?
It's like a matrix.
Yeah, a matrix. I love it. The gender matrix.
It sounds
great.
Well,
you've just named the next model. That's what it's going to be called.
I can't wait.
We'll cite you in the paper.
Oh, please.
masculinity and femininity. So you'd have a spectrum for masculine and feminine for biological configuration, for gender identity, and for expression. So you end up with like six spectra-ish, along which somebody can be masculine or feminine or neither or both or in multiple places at different times for, you know, sort of biological configuration, gender identity and gender expression. And any configuration there is part of adaptive, normal gender functioning, how we can expect gender to work in the world.
Gosh, I mean, it is just so complicated, all the different facets of what goes to create gender identity. And it's just, it's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating. And I wonder if, do you think we'll ever come to a place where we have more of an idea of how to define gender? Like, is there a truth here, or is it that it will always be theory upon theory?
I think that's science for you, isn't it? Like, science is about sort of generating theories that we think are a good proxy for the truth, and then, you know, 30 seconds later somebody comes up with a better idea and it turns out to be a better proxy for the truth, and we just keep narrowing down on something. I think there's a kind of a moral lesson here in that science is designed to approach a truth, but also there's a moral imperative to make sure that everyone is okay, right? To make sure that everybody is included and that everybody gets to live authentically in the world. Mm-hmm. And so, like, our aim is to generate a model that will make it possible for everybody to do that, that doesn't do harm, and that allows everybody to find a place in the world that is okay. So rather than kind of, I suppose there's the academic question of what genders exist in the world, what's it possible for a person to be? But I think just above that, sort of overlaying that, is the question of how do we build a world that makes everyone feel included? So when we have like boys line up over here, girls line up over here in school, you know, what, like, how does our understanding of how gender can be expected to work how would that idea cause problems for a big group of children for whom, you know, like, they are just in a diverse space on the gender spectrum? So I think what we may not be narrowing in on the ultimate truth. I mean, who knows what that's going to be, because it is quite complicated, because this is all sort of culturally specific too. We're doing a bunch of cross-cultural work with Jamie Wilson at the moment to kind of understand sort of the diversity of experiences of gender outside of the binary across the world. So we may not be able to get to a sort of universal truth there very easily, mm-hmm. but we are narrowing in on a model of gender that we can use to make sure that everybody is included. Like, it's good enough in a way that the binary certainly has not been. That has been very problematic for a huge group of children, young people, and adults too.
Yeah.
And that's, so I think finding the truth is one thing, but for me, the bigger thing is just trying to find a model that allows us all to just exist in the world and allows us to build a world where everyone can belong. That's the job.
Yeah. Your view on looking into that is so practical. And I think that that's something that comes back down to kind of who EPs are as a profession as well, like kind of more interested in, like, how does this person actually think and feel rather than looking at numbers and statistics on it.
This is absolutely, I think you're totally right. Like, we talk about children who are struggling with a number of different needs. That language is probably not ideal. But when you've got a child who is finding something difficult in school, educational psychology's job is not to kind of, you know, the system is sort of set up to ask educational psychologists, what's wrong with this child? And our educational psychologist's motivation is generally to say, actually, what's wrong with this system that this child has been highlighted as different in some way or has fallen behind in some way? And our job then is to shape the system to make sure that that child can be included. And the same goes for gender as it does for all these other things. That's why educational psychology is so perfectly placed to work with these groups, because it is all about shaping systems to become more inclusive and finding the children for whom, you know, the children that struggle are an indication of an exclusive system rather than an indication necessarily there's something wrong with this young person.
You talked very briefly about how gender is seen differently in different cultures and that work with Jamie Wilson. I wonder, could you tell us a little bit more about that?
For sure. So, yeah, Jamie's work is amazing. We've got some great pieces of work. Jamie's is a strange piece of work to me. We haven't tried to do something like this before, and that is very exciting, and I'm super thrilled that we're doing it. So what we're doing is we're starting with a systematic review of the literature, asking, effectively trying to collect all of the literature in the world, all the scientific literature that we can.
An easy task, yeah.
Yeah, it's just, yes, fun. Well, the trick to systematic reviews, as I'm sure you know, is to kind of whittle down the question, make the question narrow enough so when you're looking for an exhaustive list of the literature, actually it's not so big that you can't manage it. And so the question for us is, you know, what are people's lived experience of gender outside of the binary across the world? And actually, it's not a massive amount of literature out there, but what literature is out there is really interesting and valuable. And what we're particularly interested in is people's own experiences and descriptions of their own experiences, even if they've been collected by a researcher and sort of interpreted and described by a researcher. But we are particularly interested in that research that has actually gone to ask people about their own experiences. And our aim is to bring all of that together and ask the question, what are people's experiences of gender outside of the binary across the world? I mean, it's amazing to look at the cultures outside of Western culture, both historic and modern, that have included an aspect of gender outside of the binary in mainstream society in some way. There is a wonderful tool available on pbs.org. If you Google genders around the world, you'll find this tool on pbs.org, which is a sort of world of gender customs. It's like an atlas of the world. And you can, from there, kind of click on various places in the world, and it'll describe cultures that have endorsed some kind of gender that is broader than the binary, from sort of various kind of cultures and communities that endorse some kind of element of the two-spirit identity in Native American cultures, all the way to the kind of Wakawahine for Maori cultures in New Zealand, all the way to the Whakaleti in the Tonga, to the Hijra in India, all the way to kind of Brazil and the Travesti. There's there are really countless cultures out there that do gender differently to us. And something I think I've noticed in Western society particularly is that we have this habit of restricting what we think is normal and then sort of medicalizing everything else to some degree. Mm-hmm. And we've done that particularly with sexuality, and we've done that particularly with gender, where we sort of pathologized at things that fall outside of the norm and have taken time to realize that actually that's just part of people's lived experience, and we just need to make what we consider to be normal bigger. Mm-hmm. But what these kind of cross-cultural studies tell us is that there is something universal about genders outside of the binary. There's a kind of beautiful universality to it. That different cultures have managed that in radically different ways.
Yeah.
But the existence of people who, like, are to some degree cross-gender identified, or who fall outside of the binary, or who find fluid spaces in themselves, the sort of massive and beautiful diversity of gender has been reflected in historic cultures and across the world. Humans are just bigger than male and female, I think. Mm-hmm. Which I think is lovely. I think that's a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm. If we're talking about having that aim of people feeling included in terms of gender, being able to see how there are different areas and different cultures of the world have kind of made that a reality in some ways must be quite a nice thing, really. So we can see how it's been done differently elsewhere.
I mean, for sure. It's a very complicated situation. So we've kind of just touched very, very lightly upon some of these cultures. We could do entire episodes just deep diving into any one of them and talking about the kind of rich history of how, you know, like, for example, the Hijra in India have only recently gained legal recognition. So each culture's own way in which they've adapted and grown and developed an understanding of gender outside of the norm and adopted like genders outside of the norm into mainstream society has been quite diverse, I think. And so it'd be easy to kind of rose tint those experiences cross-culturally. Mm-hmm. But the research out there is fascinating, and I encourage you to read Jamie Wilson's when we finally finish writing it in a year or so time, because I think that'll be, you know, that's a way to sort of bring more attention to some of this research that is out there that has taken some work to kind of for us to get a hold of and to make use of in a more systemically sort of exhaustive way, bring them all together and say, you know, what does this tell us about gender?
Mm. It would be absolutely fascinating. I mean, maybe we can have both of you on and talk about it then.
We would love to. That would be great. Yeah, for sure.
I thought maybe, well, we touched on how educational psychologists can kind of help to promote more positive conceptualizations of gender in schools. And I was wondering if we might be able to talk a little bit more about that and the ways that you feel EPs could promote positive feelings within schools.
So it's we can have a lot of hope right now for the future. I think simultaneously we are in a particularly tricky socio-cultural space right now in the UK, where a lot of public figures are talking quite openly about, you know, we started a little bit before J.K. Rowling, but J.K. Rowling started to talk about, you know, quite understandably in a way, about her fears about single-sex spaces being exposed to access by men effectively. Now we must bear in mind that the Gender Recognition Act reform that sparked all of this off was never really about single-sex spaces. The Gender Recognition Act doesn't give protection to single-sex spaces. That's the Equality Act, and that was never up for kind of change. It was the Gender Recognition Act, which is just about how transgender people gain legal recognition of their gender, basically. That's the sort of legal process by which that can take place. And that reform was proposed by Theresa May and Lynn Featherstone, I think, who was the Equalities Minister at the time. It's a very trans-inclusive Equalities Minister, to be honest. Created this huge consultation that brought trans people together and the public more broadly. Ended up like 700,000 responses to this public consultation that asked people, you know, what do we need to do with the Gender Recognition Act to make it better? And the government has very recently decided to scrap those reforms largely. They're going to make the process much cheaper, but it's still quite bureaucratic. It's still problematic in a bunch of ways. not least because you have to sort of collect a bunch of information from various doctors that, for example, I don't have contact with any doctors about my gender, but I would need two specialist doctors to give me letters to be able to send to the panel to be able to get legal recognition. So, you know, for example, I'm still legally, in inverted commas, considered male.
Okay.
Except what that really means is very blurry because all of my documentation says female. It's just my birth certificate that says male.
Mm-hmm.
But with all of that context, what has happened is that, you know, the Gender Recognition Act has been quashed. Children and young people's access to hormone blockers as a treatment of choice for transgender children got kind of put on pause by a high court ruling, which has now been appealed. And we have people like J.K. Rowling and other various public figures talking about how they're worried about the liberation of the transgender community potentially causing problems for the rights of women, like cis women in the world. And implicitly sort of excluding transgender women from that definition of women.
Okay.
And that's obviously problematic. It's really problematic because we're at a point where schools are just about thinking, is it okay for us to talk about gender identity with children and young people? And is it okay for us to think about creating like unisex facilities and starting to think about how we divide children up for sports and for other activities? And we're getting there, I think. But when central government are not fully talking about trans inclusion and are kind of getting scared about talking about that stuff because of the fear that, like, their voter base, I think, the sort of more conservative UK is worried about, you know, this is going to create problems for women and worried that it's going to be affecting children and young people in a negative way. Schools, I think, would feel, I would understand schools getting cold feet about this, you know, about fully embracing this idea that we can talk to children and young people about gender identity and it's kind of okay. You know, like, this is something that we have language to understand. The research is fairly strong. We can talk to children and young people about it. We're not at risk of malleating their experiences. Instead, actually giving them a language to describe those experiences, you know, liberates us all to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's the kind of context that we're in. We're in a sort of, in a bit of a battle, I think, right now, trying to get governments on board with that idea so that we can get public policy into a place where it's fully inclusive. Mm-hmm. I mean, all we really need is governments to say very clearly, we include transgender people and moreover, like, non-binary people are valid and gender fluid experiences are valid.
Mm-hmm.
And to endorse a model of gender that kind of gives everyone a home. If we could do that, then I think we can jump on and start working with schools without any kind of problem. I do that anyway. Like, in my work with schools, I think it's a great thing to do. And that's why I'm kind of optimistic, because whenever I go into schools and talk to them about this, they are always kind of, it makes sense to people, even in terms of their own experience, where we've all, you know, had our gender to some extent policed by this binary view.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just as a woman changing attire, I'll have people come up to me and ask if I want help, which is lovely and wonderful, but nobody ever did that when I was a guy. And when I was, you know, when people experienced me to be a boy in the world, they'd listen to me, regardless of what I was saying or whether I knew what I was talking about. And now it takes me a good long second to get people to listen to what I'm having to say. And people will cut me off in the middle of a sentence. And that's just, you know, those kind of little gentle, subtle, surreptitious bits of policing of gender, they bind us all. And the more that we adopt a model of gender that kind of says, that just kind of pulls the determinism and the essentialism out of it, the more liberated we all are. And schools are all for that. And always, whenever they have worked with a child who finds themselves in an unusual place on the gender spectrum, without fault, almost without sort of exception, I have found that schools have just wanted to do the very best for that child and will kind of move mountains to make it possible. You know, I've worked with families of very young children where they've called a school on the way to school saying, look, our little person, you know, as you know, dresses as a girl at home and we just couldn't get her out the door today as a boy. She's going to come to school today as a girl for the first time.
Just a heads up.
Can you put things in place? And the school is like, they'll move mountains to make it happen, you know. So, and working with this community, is actually very straightforward, because educational psychology is about environmental change. And all we need to do is get simple changes in place to move systems out of the way to allow a person to explore their gender in peace. Mm. And wherever they land, find acceptance.
Yeah.
And that's actually very straightforward. I've worked with a good few young people where the primary need is like emotional well-being, and their behavior in school is really troubling them. They're struggling in their studies and their emotional well-being is difficult, and school referring them for behavior difficulties in inverted commas. And when you find that the problem is simply that, you know, they feel about themselves, you know, in terms of their gender in a particular way, and feel like they're not going to be welcome in the world. It's something so fundamental that it affects everything. If you spot that that's going on and you just move things out of the way, for that handful of kids, it just changes everything. I've seen young people sort of almost change overnight with just finding that the world might accept them. You know, that's all it takes for some of these kids. Yeah. And so hope is right. Like educational psychology, and not least because the BPS released their guidance for working with sexual and gender diversity. Worth checking out the BPS guidance, because it's incredibly progressive and inclusive, and guess what? Driven by the science. Who would have thought? So it's worth checking out. Also, Northern Ireland's guidance, actually, from the Educational Authority in Northern Ireland is very good. British government has yet to create national guidance. Surprise, surprise. I love you, British government. Don't think I don't, but, you know, come on, get on board. We're here.
I can hear the frustration in your voice with these huge things that are completely out of your control. And yet, you know, being an advocate for something like this that you're so passionate about is a really good way of trying to move things in the right direction.
It's yeah, I mean, I hope so, in some small way. It does drive me a little bit bonkers, I would say, because was it the gender certificate, I can't remember, gender recognition certificate or something like that, that basically says this is the gender that I am if you're a transgender person. It's such a difficult process to go through that of the hundreds of thousands, like 200, 300,000 transgender women in the UK, probably a lot more than that, realistically, only 5,000 of them have ever used this system. 5,000. Gotta be kidding me. It's like it's designed to make it difficult. And a cynical person might say that that's maybe what it's designed to do. And the waiting lists for, you know, medical care for transgender children, adolescents, and for adults is impossibly long. Mm-hmm. Apologies were just made for, I think, Exeter's gender identity clinic. There's one in the West, the only one in the West, that has a waiting list of up to 5 years for first appointments in an NHS that's recommended waiting time is 16 weeks. That's been the case, you know, the waiting list for the transgender community, both children, young people and adults, has been extremely long for an extremely long period of time. Why doesn't it change? Cynical person might say there just isn't the political will. We certainly have the science to suggest that it is a good idea that we do more of this stuff. And actually, we have no healthcare for the non-binary community at all. Even though there was some stuff released in Canada very recently talking about the importance of maybe providing healthcare, you know, transition support services for the non-binary community, not in the same way as the trans community, the needs aren't the same. And there are various non-binary communities out there whose needs will be different, but to assume they don't need it might be a problem.
Okay. So it sounds like a lot of the support that is kind of on a UK-wide scale in terms of healthcare isn't necessarily there for quite a long time for children. I'm thinking that that probably highlights the impact that schools need to have and the support that they need to support for non-binary children
for
and
sure.
transitioning yeah. children.
I mean, there's loads of gender-diverse children, young people out there. And the medical services that are available are outstanding. Like, we have some amazing people in the gender identity clinics for children, young people. It's a question of funding to make them as big as they need to be for the number of children, young people that are coming forward. And that's a political problem rather than a sort of clinical problem. And you're right, I think, to suggest that in the lieu of better services, you know, these young people are going to be in more distress for longer and without appropriate support for longer. And schools as the first line of defense for basically everything in a child and young person's life, as they become increasingly the, you know, one place that does basically everything for children and young people in need. They're in a position where they're needed more, I think, for this community, just to provide them with a place to belong and an idea that the world is going to be inclusive for them and it's going to be okay. Just to hold them over while help is coming, because it'll take a while to arrive, maybe.
Okay. So I'm wondering if there's anything that you would like EPs to know about kind of what could be done in terms of best practice in the classroom.
I think the first job, I think, is just as we're trying to do as a profession more broadly, is to try and put ourselves in the shoes of people who are not as privileged as educational psychologists tend to be. And the gender minority community is a good example of that, where we kind of look at the structures and systems in place in schools and wonder what would it be like if you didn't identify as male or female, or if you identified as a gender that was different to the one you've been assigned. How would those kind of basic systems and structures create problems? So if you see, for example, teachers saying, we're going to sit you down, boy, girl, boy, girl, that's going to be fine for like 97% of the community. But it's that small percentage that their day could change remarkably by that not being the case and by us just kind of having an awareness of gender diversity and how we put things together. And I think that's the primary thing that they can do. The second thing I think that educational psychologists can do is just be the people that can support this community. I think there's probably a little bit of kind of reluctance from educational psychology, not sure that this is our area of expertise, not sure that we can, that we're the right people to get involved. But there really aren't many people getting involved. You know, we have the charitable sector and we have the gender services more broadly. Like I said before, like gender fluid communities, non-binary communities, and a lot of gender variant communities generally don't have access to those services at all. And those that do have to wait for them. So these children and young people need people who are specialists in environmental change and inclusion primarily. And I can't think of anybody who are the architects of environmental change more than educational psychologists. I mean, perhaps architects, they might be the architects of environmental change more than us, but we're good at it. You know, we're good at inclusion. And this is literally just another element of inclusion. We're just trying to identify, you know, when children feel like they're being excluded in some way, what is it about the system that's making them feel excluded, and try and malleate it so that they are included fully, just in terms of their gender here, rather than in terms of a learning need or some other need that we might get involved for. So it's not going to be like children are unlikely to be referred to us for this reason, but it's often the case that it might be in there somewhere. And where we see it, it's kind of okay for us to sort of, I mean, generally speaking, you know, educational psychologists know the limits of their own experience and expertise better than anybody else. But my sense would be that this is just about inclusion, really. And other people can manage the sort of within child change and the sort of, you know, the medical support that needs to go along with some of these things. But making sure that kids are included is in our wheelhouse very much.
I mean, definitely. I feel like there is so much of a child's life that is spent in school. And if I'm also thinking about the language that's used in schools. I mean, I've noticed that when you're talking about children, you're usually saying this parent's little person rather than little boy or little girl. I really like that. I think I'll definitely start using that rather than starting even all my advices by saying so-and-so is a confident young boy or whatever. It's just kind of not really necessary in some ways, I feel now. So, yeah.
I think you're right. I think it goes into things like when we're writing reports or working with a child, young person, it applies to us too, in that if a child and young person is saying, you know, I identify as a girl, or, you know, I'd like, you know, I'm using this name right now, that we just kind of endorse that in a person-centered way, as long as they're sort of out in a way that, you know, without outing them immediately by how I write our reports, you know, keeping them safe, but kind of validating their experience at the core. Validating their experience of gender actually is one of the biggest things that anybody can do for any person, just, you know, believe them.
Yeah.
You know, and if they tell us that, you know, they experience their gender to be this way, just listen and validate that experience.
Yeah. I'm just remembering how you've described when you were on the course as being like feeling like you were so accepted and feeling like it was home. You'd made a home for yourself in terms of the people that you had surrounding you and supporting you. And I think if EPs could try and use these inclusive practices to make children feel in any way as good as maybe that made you feel at the time, you know, that would be lovely.
Yeah, for sure. I've worked with a handful of young people who were struggling in school because of their gender. They felt excluded and have moved schools as a result of things like that. And for those young people where I've just been involved for that reason, I've been in going into the school and just treating this, you know, young girl as a girl like anybody, any other girl in the school, bearing in mind like common sense issues around she might be at risk, you know, in certain environments, even though you can treat her as a girl like any other girl in the school. You know, if she's in the girls' bathroom, for example, then you have to bear in mind that she might be at risk of bullying being in there. So you have to have a common sense approach, but simultaneously we don't tell her she can't go in there because she's not a real girl is absolutely not what we would do. And helping her to see in your eyes that you see her as a girl, and helping other people to see her as a girl like any other girl, is like that. It can have such a profound impact on young people's lives, just seeing that happen. If we can be that person, then there's no greater thing that we can do, I think.
Yes. I think something else that I'm thinking about while you've been talking is the idea of changing things for every child, not just the ones that are overtly kind of saying that they have got some gender identity that they want to maybe change or think about more. If we could change the environment for every child so that it's less gendered, then that also has an impact on so much. Even, you know, boys not being able to express their emotions so well, that could change. Or girls not wanting to do maths, that could change.
Absolutely.
It's really breaking down those categories.
Yeah, for sure. Like that's a really good example of kind of heteronormative and cisnormative practice creating a strange set of gendered norms that people are going to feel like they adhere to. And it's going to kind of guide their behavior in a way that might be unhelpful for them. Let's absolutely fight those things. What I find really helpful is fighting those things in a way that's funny.
Yeah.
If that sounds weird, like exposing it to people in a way that's non-judgmental. That I think is critical, actually. My whole career I've been trying to do this kind of stuff, particularly for the last 10 years in various places, trying to help people to think about gender in new ways perhaps. And the stuff that I found works most frequently is when you expose it to people in a way that makes them laugh, that certainly in a way that doesn't make them feel judged for their kind of, for the norms that they hold or for their sort of assumptions that they bring. It can't be about the trans community or gender diverse communities versus the cisgender communities. It needs to be all of us versus kind of hetero and cis normativity, right? It's about all of us together versus gender essentialism. Mm-hmm. Because when we do that, we can all laugh at the daft stuff that gender essentialism makes us assume about each other. Mm-hmm. And then that helps us to challenge it and we do a better job of kind of opening up possibilities for each other.
Yeah, I really like that idea. And I think you do bring a lot of humour to it. I think part of possibly the reason why gender isn't taught so well in schools is because of, you know, the act that you were talking about earlier with Margaret Thatcher and how that has had an impact on different generations kind of going back. And if you're raised in a society where you don't talk about the non-bimodal system of gender, then surely you're going to feel quite stunted in the way that you can talk about it and the way that you can discuss it. But using humour, I think, is wonderful and kind of making people feel a little bit more relaxed about feeling able to make mistakes.
Yeah, being able to make mistakes, I think, is one of the things that I hear from schools most frequently, actually, is where they're worried they're going to get something wrong and do harm. And so it becomes a taboo. They can't really talk about it with the young person. They try and, you know, with the best of intentions, trying not to make it worse. I think it's kind of okay to make mistakes, actually. If we're trying to get it right, I think there's a big difference between kind of doing something malicious and doing something that's a mistake when we're trying desperately to get it right. Because when we get it wrong, we're having the conversation. And that allows us to kind of learn and get it better next time, right? That's what helps us to sort of to get the language right, to understand what we need to do differently that will help support a young person. If we end up avoiding the topic, then we'll never get it right. And then when we try, we'll still make mistakes, but we just won't make mistakes so often because we're trying to avoid it. So yeah, for sure. But I think that starts with us as a trans community, as a gender diverse community. I think where we can, like, we need to be understanding of the position that people are in when they're in kind of heavily conservative with a small c, like gender essentialist maybe sort of highly religious, like we know that religious fundamentalism could be associated with a bit of transphobia or gender essentialism. So we have to be empathetic to the situation that people find themselves in, those kind of cultural contexts or like social and familial contexts and individual experience. We can't judge people for the way they see the world as long as what they're trying to do is learn.
Mm-hmm.
And so we, our community, being like as tolerant of other people's views as we can and teaching people in a way that hopefully makes them laugh, but more allows them to learn, I think is a really good way to do it. I think what we've seen with people like J.K. Rowling is that she has, my guess would be, like felt increasingly defensive as a response to sort of the community's response to her tweets. And then she wrote an essay in the community and it's just made everyone's position a little more entrenched. Nobody's understanding each other. I mean, Twitter's never a good place to understand one another. It's just a really good place to scream into the void. The way that we use it tends to be not the best to help each other understand each other's experience. We just got to try and we've got to raise the tone of the debate and we've got to listen to each other more and start to freaking learn from each other more because, you know, nobody's on the other side of that.
Mm.
J.K. Rowling saying, you know, we need to protect women. Nobody's on the other side of that debate. Like, nobody is on the other side of that. Nobody thinks that women don't need to be protected or shouldn't have access to those spaces that they fought so hard for to be protected and feel safe. But on the other side of that, we have a group of trans women who you're excluding from that definition, potentially, of women. So, you know, if we can find a way to just have the conversation together and just... there is common ground here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like two different battles that are fighting different enemies but getting confused about who each other are fighting. It's
yes, for sure. For sure. Like we're all trying to tackle cisnormative culture and heteronormative culture, right?
Yeah.
We're just catching each other in the crossfire a little bit too much.
Yeah. I think that brings us to a bit of an ending point, Cora. So I'm wondering if there's anything that you would like to say that you haven't already, or any kind of final thoughts.
I don't know. It's been a great pleasure. I've enjoyed it. It's a strange little space,
mm-hmm.
Talking on a podcast. I mean, I used to have Classroom Psychology back in the day, which was my own little baby podcast. We did literature reviews. And these days we have TEP Talks at the university where our trainees do a bit of podcasting of their own. It's a wonderful and strange space to have this kind of platform to talk about these issues in a kind of open way, talk about the science. And I think is that these kind of platforms are a unique opportunity to connect the science with practice, right? We're talking about how science has impacted and informed public policy and changing public policy over time. We're talking about how the public debate could be informed better by the science and how that could allow us to sort of talk using the same language a bit more and to listen to each other better. I think it's a good platform to do that kind of stuff, actually, to bring science and public policy, to bring them together maybe a little bit better, and hope that we can make just a little bit of change in terms of public policy in the UK. That's what we'd really like to see. More public policy that looks after gender diverse communities and maybe just one or two more statements from central government about how non-binary people are valid in the world. Just, you know, a couple of statements like that. Boris, seeing him sweep his beautiful hair to one side and say, hey, non-binary community, I see you. Now, trans community, you're all welcome here. That would be great.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Cora. It's been such a pleasure to be able to talk to you about this. It's felt a little bit like my own little private lecture, and I'm so excited to be able to share that with everybody else. It's just been funny and interesting, and you have so much knowledge of it, which is just fantastic to hear all about. So, yeah, thank you so much.
You're very kind, Ella. Thanks so much for inviting me.